Welcome to Machine Visions, a show about the acceleration of robotics deployed across every sector of our economy. I'm Nan Lee, Managing Director at Obvious Ventures. In this five-part series, we dive into the current breakout moment in industrial robotics, where next-gen robots are taking on new challenges and scaling rapidly in production. We'll bring you the inside story from leading voices in this industry to understand what's happening today and what's to come. Today's episode features Amar Hanspal, co-founder and CEO of Bright Machines, and former co-CEO and chief product officer at Autodesk, where he worked for 15 years. We discuss the microfactory, the Goldilocks approach to customer fit, and his quest to make creating physical products as easy as digital products. I think your background is so fascinating because you've been in the industrial space for such a long time, and you have a very different vantage point than someone who's first kicking off a company as an entrepreneur, or even someone who's been in the industry, but only from an exec position. You recently wrote in Forbes that today the general perception is that manufacturing is risk-averse and a mind-numbing activity where nothing innovative happens. I'm paraphrasing, but you said that nothing could be further from the truth. So just to kick off, you know, tell us more about this fascinating quote. You know, why do you think this misperception exists in the first place?
I've spent my career in the manufacturing and construction industries, but a majority of that has been building software for design and engineering purposes. And it always struck me that those activities in those industries were very driven by innovation, right? Everybody's thinking about form, function, you know, just aesthetics and lots of innovation that takes place in the upfront part. But it was also pretty striking that when I spoke with customers, is that when those designs cross the transom, let's say into the factory, management in particular was constraining that activity, not by saying, hey, I want you to innovate, but it was more, I want you to guarantee that this thing will be made for X dollars, this much volume, and that there will be no flaws in the process. Well, when you constrain it that way, you turn this stuff into like, what is the most predictable, repeatable process? And that's kind of where the mind numbing comes from. Nobody gets rewarded for, let's try something completely different. Let's experiment. Let's iterate, which is what happens all in the design and engineering front. In the manufacturing universe, it's all about, okay, I've been handed these constraints. How do I make sure I don't violate these constraints of cost or time or quality? And that's why I think you go into factories and it's a little bit like going into a time machine. They haven't changed in 40 years. You still see hundreds and thousands of people wandering around doing things by hand. You see paper everywhere. The other part of my observation, just nothing is further from the truth, comes is that people who are on the factory floor within those constraints are amazing problem solvers. The thing that I just love about that universe is the number of industrial and process and manufacturing engineers you meet who you would hand almost an impossible product to make and they'll figure out how to make it. And that's the other side that's true. So you have this weird sort of dichotomy. On the one hand, they're really thinking out of the box on how to make something. But then once they figure out how to make it, they're like really taking all the risk out of the system and making it very predictable.
And their work sort of showcases that, because even though there hasn't been that many advances in the way that factories are fundamentally run or built, the products that are churning out of these factories are incredibly advanced, constantly shape-shifting. And if you look at what's happened in consumer electronics, fast fashion, industrial design, it's amazing that without complete overhaul and process, that manufacturing is still keeping up.
Exactly.
And these things are in our hands as consumers. So it almost makes you so optimistic of what could be
right, if
we reevaluated that fundamental assumption that the factory floor is sacred and it can't be changed.
Right. And I think what's also happening now is that they have reached the rate limits of the thing that made it all possible. Up until now, you could throw people at the problem. What happens is that in the last 30 years, globalization was the biggest sort of capacity creating X factor in the world of manufacturing. People figured out, hey, I can find these low-cost pools of labor around the world. So if I need to up volume or do this difficult process, you know, I'll hire 30,000, 100,000 people to go do this for me, right, halfway around the world. Well, I think we've reached the limit of how many people are willing to do jobs in factories. And I always hear about, well, robots are going to take people's jobs. But really, when you go into a factory these days, there are robots. It just happen to be humans. Like, the humans are doing really repetitive tasks over and over again. And I think what you're starting to hear over and over again is that, hey, man, we can't keep throwing people at the problem. This has to change. We have to do things differently. It's not just about technology. Even to keep our repeatable process going, we need other ways to scale capacity than what we've been doing for the last 30 years. I think we are running out of people. While the demand for products keeps rising, the available capacity to build those products is shrinking.
Totally, totally. Just getting more into Bright Machines. Bright Machines has such an interesting founding story, which is somewhat different than the history of most startups. So I'd love to start there. Can you walk us through how the company got started originally?
Like many Silicon Valley companies, it started over a lunch. Let's put it that way. But two of my co-founders had been involved in the contract manufacturing business and had been experiencing this labor shortage issue themselves. You know, one of my co-founders, a guy called Zai Rodrigue, was at Flex for many years. And I think at one point he had 140 factories that he was managing around the world. And he would share the story that he was hiring 10,000 people a month in China alone to keep up, not just with the demand, but with the churn rate, that people join the labor pool and then depart in 6 months' time because they'd get bored or tired or get a better job. So Zai, at some point, started creating a team inside Flex to go try and do automation at scale. And he started to realize that automation today is fundamentally an expensive, time-consuming, and relatively inflexible activity. Mm-hmm. So he was like, you know, frustrated that if somebody came to him and said, I have this automation thing I need to set up for building this router, it would take him 18 to 24 months to set it up, millions of dollars. And basically, people didn't have time or budget to be able to do that. And he was like, okay, if automation is the answer, it's not economically viable. So he had this kind of challenge. And I left Autodesk in 2017 and was wandering, meeting people in Silicon Valley, trying to think about what to do next. And it was pretty clear to me that one of the most fundamental technical building blocks that was available was machine learning and computer vision. My friend once said, hey, for 50 years, we've built a software industry based on the fact that computers can count. Now computers can see. What problems can you go solve if computers can see now? Yeah. And then Zahi and then Lior, who was eventually our investor, and I met for lunch, and they described the problem set that they were thinking about. And they were describing, it was like, this is fundamentally a software problem. And the software problem, we can go build a layer, a control layer of software to change the economics of deployment, drive assembly lines the way people are driving autonomous cars, you know, control a bunch of hardware effectively with a control software layer. And that was the founding story of the company. To do it, we took Zai's team out of Flex. So Flex became our first customer and an investor on the cap table. But since then, we've been productizing this idea. And that was the story behind Bright Machines.
And you touched on this point that the ever-expanding capabilities associated with software and the controls layer of robotics. And then that must be the eyes and brains of manufacturing that's associated with Bright Machines. But what does that mean to you in terms of the deployment of the different components that go into automation?
If you want to change the entire time cycle of deploying automation, you fundamentally have to connect the means of manufacturing to the design process. At the very end, you look at how software is made today. You know, I can write software and I can deploy software in one sort of connected experience, right? So you and I can write an application, deploy it to the cloud, and then have it play back to us. So the making of digital products is the way the physical product should be made. So that is our ultimate North Star at Bright Machines, is we want to make the making of physical products as straightforward as the making of digital products is today. But there's a lot of elements in that stack to go solve, and we can't solve all of them in one go. The starting place for us was, you know, if you look at the assembly line and you're trying to program all these various systems, the first challenge is they all have to be programmed separately. So an assembly line today requires robot programming, requires feeder programming, requires conveyor programming, requires vision programming, requires tool programming, like a gripper screwdriver. They're all programmed differently in different stacks, which means that you're basically, when you're programming these systems, you have to be like an orchestra conductor. You have to teach every instrument and then make sure they're all in sync. So now what happens when one change shows up, you've got to reprogram everything to account for that change. So the first problem we set out to solve is, how can we program all of these things in one shot? Just the way your operating system today manages all of the hardware. I don't have to manage the microphone separately from the speaker, separately from the screen, right? It's managing all of those. There are other levels we have to go beyond that. If you really want to take time out of the system, eventually we have to loop all the way back to, somebody makes a change in the design, the machines should automatically adapt to it. That's the real final destination. But right now, all we're trying to do is, you know, in the crawl before we walk kind of scenario, is, hey, can we get all these five things programmed with one system as opposed to six, seven different programming stacks?
So I'd love to dive more into that product. You know, right now you have the Microfactory and then you have Brightware. Can you talk a little bit about the product journeys of those as the manifestation of that vision?
Brightware is the fundamental core IP that we are creating as a company, but it needs a reference hardware implementation for it to work. If we thought of ourselves as Android, we needed the Pixel phone as a reference implementation to make sure that we were doing the right, or Nexus phone or whatever it was called when it first came out, to make sure that things would work. And the manufacturing world, because if we are giving brains and eyes in the software layer, we need the muscle to actually make the product. And that's what the hardware effectively represents. And then the concept came out of there that, you know, each one of these cells was effectively a replacement for three or four humans carrying out various tasks. And that what you would do is you'd string them together. You could say like Lego blocks, but really our mental model has always been the data center, right? People rack servers in a data center. We are like, hey, can you horizontally rack these things into an assembly line? And then what Brightware will do is come in and configure each one of these systems to do the task or set of tasks that they need to do. And in fact, sequence it across all the cells that are in the assembly line. So we started with the hardware, we built the software, and then the hardware and software have been going in tandem since then. And our term microfactory basically means an automated assembly line, which is software powered. It's just our affectionate term for it.
And just as a product philosophy, the microfactory is a really interesting one in the sense of the modular and siloed design principle. I could see many benefits to doing it this way so that you don't really have to integrate into the existing factory environment. But would love to just kind of hear about the benefits to building modular factories that are sort of standalone within the facilities that you're in. And are there any downsides of doing it that way?
So what the modular approach lets us do is effectively configure the system in our, what we call our integration center. So the customer sends us the product they want assembled, and we configure these modules, we plug them together, we give them the right grippers, and then we use our software to program these modular cells to build these products. And so we can tune all of that in our integration center, and then we can pack it and ship it to the customer's factory and commission it there. There's a big benefit to, as a unit, make something work, make sure it's working, and then have it replicated at the customer's site. And in fact, because the logic of how these things work is captured in software, we're able to replicate that same assembly line in multiple locations for a customer. So, you know, it's like what we call write once, build anywhere. This modular approach, software-based approach lets us do that. It's really abstract the configuring of things from the actual, where the product actually has to be made.
And it reduces the contextual dependencies of the factory has to be this way, or the backend integration has to be deployed before we're there. A lot of that really helps with scalability.
Absolutely.
Effectively, once you get one dialed in, the second through the nth is not any more overhead than that initial first one.
And so think about something like COVID, man. I mean, we were able to work and configure these systems in locations where we didn't have restrictions, and then deploy them into a physical facility for the customer when they were ready to accept it. A certain part of the world was shut down. We were still able to configure the systems in Mexico, for example, for that customer, because we are able to use this kind of approach.
And this kind of approach is very unique. You know, as you mentioned, the standard understanding of automation is that an integrator shows up, does a scope of work project, goes away and works on it for a year, and then comes back and starts to implement it. So this is something that's entirely different.
Right.
You know, when you introduce this concept to the world for your first few customers, you know, any learnings around messaging that correctly? I imagine there's a lot of change management in terms of introducing a totally new paradigm of automation instead of, you know, I'm going to automate one workstation at a time, standard process, standard operating procedure.
What I remember about the journey is that we went to the customers. They liked this message of this sort of software-defined modular assembly line approach. That nobody pushed back on the idea. In fact, they said, this makes all the sense in the world. They had maybe three things they wanted to make sure. One, that it worked. So nobody was willing to take the leap of faith and say, sure, man, send me seven of these things. So what we observed was they'd say, okay, can you do this one thing? I just want to make sure that this one task, even before you go to this whole assembly line, just show me that you can replace this one task to begin with. So there was something there about, you know, Silicon Valley, we can change the world. And they're like, okay, like, slow down, man. Can you do this one thing? So I think that was one thing that we learned was for 6 or 9 months, we were overshooting what the people were willing to listen. We were really trying to say, hey, we can go to the highest people in the company and they'll be super excited that software's come to manufacturing. And most of them were like, I got other fish to fry. Make sure this one thing works. So I think that was one learning. And I would always say, for all the highfalutin stories you tell, make sure that there is a very, very real and practical way to implement the idea. So that was one learning. The second thing that we learned from our entire experience was to be clear about what our differentiation was. Because we were, as a result of our approach, not necessarily going to be the cheapest solution out there. In fact, we continue to be priced at a premium to what they could get in a different way. So it was always very clear, like, let's be clear, what's the benefit for the customer to do it our way? Fine, we use software, we use modular hardware. We're not giving them a price benefit. What is the benefit we're giving them? And so, you know, I would say sometimes it's time to market that we've been able to give our customers. We're able to configure and deploy these systems faster than a year or whatever it would take the alternative way. We've been able to say, hey, we can give you flexibility. This is one of those things that's important to customers, is that they understand their product changes. And that's something they are worried about, that they make all this big investment and then the investment goes away because the product changes and all the CapEx has to be reworked. Being very clear about your differentiation, especially to the alternatives that customers have, is the second thing I would say, you know, you go learn. And then the third one for us is just figuring out, of all the customers you could go to, who is the customer that would be the most valuable? And in our universe, in manufacturing, you have people who are OEMs, and an OEM is an original equipment manufacturer. You have people who have ODMs, device manufacturers, and there are people who are contract manufacturers. And I think we learned over time, You know, we started at one end of the food chain, which was in contract manufacturing, and we've moved up the food chain much more into the OEM. And the OEM has much more interest in connecting all of the pieces of the product and manufacturing process and eventually landing on that customer. That was the third thing that, you know, it's taken us 2.5 years to figure this stuff out, but and many scars on our back. But those were the three things I would say is that don't overshoot your message. Make sure you understand who your customer really is and what your differentiation is when you go in front of them.
And it seems like out of the gate, the micro factories that you build already apply to quite a wide range of industries. And from what I can gather online, you know, right now your micro factories apply to everything from coffee dispensing machines to wireless alarm systems. I think that generalist versus specialist approach is always a trade-off in designing hardware, robotics, automation systems. So how have you been able to navigate that? You know, to not go too generalist where you need a lot of integration and custom work, or too specialist where you can only make a shoe or something like that?
We started with a couple of constraints, deliberate constraints. One of the constraints that we started with was our build envelope. We decided that we would create a payload of about 15 kilograms and have a build envelope of about 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet. And a lot of that came from the fact that the big opportunities we saw was in network infrastructure. Some of it came from our heritage because we had a team that was skilled at understanding how to put this together, the extraction of the team from Flex. But we also saw that if you kind of focus there, there was a whole range of products that the big guys were not chasing. The robots may have been around for many years, but they've really been building products that are long capital cycle and have high dollar volume. So you see them in big automotive, big aerospace situations. You go to a factory that's building a router, you don't see robots assembling that router. So like, okay, there's a little blue ocean space here. We can go there. Our team understands how to build it. The big guys are not chasing it. That's kind of where we started. And we have done about 80 deployments since we started. You know, we brought product to market. We were founded in 2018, brought product to market in 2019. And the one place that we took a leap across was consumer products. So when you mentioned coffee machines, and again, then that I would say was a little opportunistic because when COVID came, the demand for all of that spiked. You know, people were buying coffee machines and staying at home. And so we had this unique opportunity where people came to us and said, hey, we like what you do, but we need you to build this product, which is not electronic-centric. It's kind of metals and plastics, and we've been learning how to build those products now.
But because the product architecture is modular in the first place, I imagine that there's still a consistent identity of the platform.
Exactly. I mean, the software platform has this concept in a little bit like Alexa skills, where as it learns to do a certain type of operation, that operation effectively is memorized for other assembly lines, right? So the most exaggerated way to say it would be, hey, once one of our robots learns how to insert a screw, then all our robots learn how to insert a screw. And that's somewhat true. I mean, what is the reality is every screw is slightly different. Every socket is slightly different. You do have to work at it. But the more work we do, the smarter our system becomes and the more knowledge transfer happens between these assembly lines.
Yeah, and in another world, that would just be called object-oriented programming.
Exactly, exactly.
And that's what I wanted to get into a little bit here, is that you've had a lot of miles traveled in industrials and also in software. So I'm curious how that background, particularly a software-centric background with Autodesk and RedSpark, how does that influence the way that you think about building hardware and think about growing fundamentally a deployment-based hardware business?
And software inherently, you know, when you structure or you write code, you always think of things in modules to begin with, right? You're always trying to think about reusability, configurability. So I think that's reflected a little bit in the hardware choices that we're making and the hardware design choices we're making is we are approaching this as we can't do this in a custom way. How do we do this in a way that is plug and play and interchangeable and transferable across customer deployments? So I think that is one thing. The other thing I think you always think about is how can you simplify? And you can be smart about things that really need to be real time and things that can be near real time, you know, so you can compute and leverage those resources efficiently. You start thinking about what really needs to be done on the production line versus what can be offloaded and done on the cloud and returned over time. So I think there's ways in which software thinking also lets you simplify and challenge sort of an orthodox approach of like, hey, listen, if I'm risk averse, I'm putting everything on the production line. And you go, no, you don't have to do it. And I think, you know, you've seen this in other industries. You've seen things in electric cars, for example, 7 moving parts. They're like, we don't have to put all this stuff in the electric car. You need like 7 things to make the car move. That's what we'll put, and put everything else in software. I think the modular approach, simplification, those are the things that I think we were able to bring from our software background.
It's really amazing that you've been able to pull that off, because I think that traditionally you pay for that modularity. You pay for it with maybe higher BOM costs than you could get it down to, and maybe deployment speed and efficiency. And that's why, you know, a lot of machines out in the industrial world are very specialized, because they've been forced to be. So how have you been able to avoid some of those pressures of essentially commodity machines?
I think my honest answer is I think we're still learning. We've only done 80 deployments. We have a lot more to do. I think right now we have a sweet spot, right? When things become extremely high volume, like Coca-Cola bottling machines, our modular hardware could never keep up with that speed. When the volume becomes extremely high, we don't do great. When the volume becomes extremely low, we also don't do very great, because there's a Goldilocks effect. Like you do really well in reasonably high volume and reasonably high mix. Otherwise, you're changing grippers and things way too often, right? So I think there's a sweet spot. So I think one part of the answer to your question is we figured out what kinds of things to engage in, where we do well, and try and stay in that swim lane and not get distracted. Trust me, people have come to us and said, can you do this? Can you do that? Can you do this? Can you make a part for a rocket that's low volume? We've turned it down. Sometimes somebody's come and said, can you make 3 million of this pharmaceutical thing? I mean, like, that's too high volume. And we're like, no. So I think saying no sometimes is as important as saying yes.
Yeah.
I think we've just also got a very talented team. I think these guys have, we do benefit from having the yin and yang in our company of what I call the manufacturing process nerds and the computer science nerds in one room. They have violent debates and they each sort of challenge each other from time to time. And sometimes magic happens and sometimes it doesn't happen. But when it happens, it helps us constrain and do these things really well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an amazing lesson. Know thyself. And it's a tried and true lesson, but rarely taken up by new founders. I think it's frequently the mistake that companies make is being too eager to serve the first customer and pulling the platform in a different direction than initially engineered or architected.
Right, exactly.
As you get into the next 100 deployments, how do you think Bright Machines matures as a company? You know, now that you're on your way to being a publicly listed company, what are some of the changes that you're preparing yourself for in the next chapter?
There's two things that sort of are underpinning our change. You know, one is what our customers want us to do. The other is, as you mentioned, becoming a public company. And actually becoming a public company is a more describable and relatable thing, I would say. You know, everybody understands you have more scrutiny, so you have to have more compliance functions. You have to be more predictable in your revenue model, so you need more of that kind of process and infrastructure. So you become a less shoot-from-the-hip kind of company. You need to be a little bit more thoughtful and transparent in a good way as a public company. I'd say the bigger change that we're driving is what our customers want us to do. And I think what we've started to understand is for our customers, the microfactory is an important step, but it's a first step to digitizing their factory floor. And what they really want to do is run a continuous improvement process, right? And manufacturing is always one of these things that if you made something in 10 seconds, can you make it in 9.9 seconds tomorrow, right? It has that kind of continuous improvement mentality. And so what they're really looking as a next step beyond doing the microfactory and assembly automation is using the data to improve their process and product design. And I think one of the changes we are driving as a result is broadening our product portfolio so that in addition to the microfactory and all of the control software layer, that we start to give our customers analytics to improve their process and insights into their product design that they could up their performance, if you will.
Interesting. And I want to end here with a little bit of a look forward. And as companies like Bright pioneer the next generation of technologies going into these factories to up-level a bunch of different capabilities that we've talked about, when you fast forward, say, 5-10 years, how do you think this will translate into the state of manufacturing broadly or more tangibly what consumers can expect from their purchasing and from their product experience?
I have two dreams. One is I want the making of physical things to be as easy as the making of digital products. If I'm an engineer and I come up with an idea, I should be able to ask the universe, can you make this for me? And the universe should be able to come back and say, yes, I can make it for you. And that connection between my mind and my idea and the actual physical making of things should become a lot easier, a lot simpler. If you're an engineer and you want to have a product made, it's like being in Harry Potter and going to the professor of dark arts, right? Nobody knows, like, how do you make this thing? And this mumbo jumbo, and you're going to go halfway around the world and figure out these, you know, do this, that, the other. Manufacturing is not straightforward. It does feel like a dark art. And that's the thing 10 years from now, we should change. And if we change it, I do think it'll unleash some innovation because more people will be encouraged to, you know, build things. I think 3D printing, I think the kind of things we are doing, those are all parts of the future. And I think that's one thing I'm hopeful for. And if you're not an engineer, but you're somebody that receives the product, I would like your experience of receiving your product to be like Domino's Pizza, right? When I order Domino's Pizza, in 30 minutes, I can track it. You have that famous pizza tracker. You know exactly where everything is. Well, I'll tell you, Nan, I like playing tennis. I ordered a custom tennis racket about 3.5 months ago. I have no idea what those guys are doing. Like, unless I go call the 800 number, I have no idea. And I'm just hoping digital technologies will do a better job of saying, here is where we are. And I just keep me informed so I have a better experience. This goes back to the things that we take for granted in our digital life are simply not true when you get to the physical universe. And I just that's the simpler idea I have, the goal I have for the world of manufacturing, better customer service, and then longer term, you know, unleashing innovation.
Well, I ordered a piece of furniture nearly a year ago. I'm still waiting for that. So good luck with you on your tennis racket.
That's great.
This is great. I think this is a great place to wrap and just feel that optimism, both in terms of seeing the tractable progress that you've accomplished with the entire team at Bright. So congratulations on that. But just what that means as a preview for what's ahead is undeniably exciting for those who nerd out on the industry like us, but also just for the everyday consumer for what the future might hold. So thanks for sharing some of that with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Amar Hanspal, co-founder and CEO of Bright Machines. Thanks for listening to this final episode of our 5-part series on next-gen robotics. Machine Visions is produced by Obvious Ventures in partnership with Pod People. Obvious invests in purpose-driven companies reimagining trillion-dollar industries. To learn more about us and where we invest, head to obvious.com. Special thanks to our production team, Gabe Kleiman and Liz Ganaw from Obvious, and the team at Pod People, Rachel King, Amy Machado, Emily Shaw, Madison Lesby, and Veronica Simonetti. I'm Nan Lee. Thanks for listening.